Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the executive action on gun safety announced today at the White House, with President Obama tearing up as he recalled the massacre of elementary school children at Sandy Hook and the NRA's grip on Congress that blocked the demand of a majority of Americans that military-style weapons be kept out of the hands of criminals and the mentally ill. A 30-year law enforcement veteran who served as a special agent with the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, Dr. William Vizard, Professor Emeritus and Chair of the Division of Criminal Justice at California State University, Sacramento, and author of In the Crossfire, A Political History of the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, joins us to discuss how Obama can get around the Congress to hire more ATF agents to improve federal gun licensing and more FBI personnel to conduct background checks. Then we'll speak with the co-author of a new study that examines the underlying dynamics of income inequality based on 35 years of data from the Social Security Administration that finds the top quarter of 1% are pulling away from the rest of us. Fatih Guvenen, a professor of economics at the University of Minnesota who's currently a visiting professor at Yale University and a research consultant for the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis, joins us to discuss the issue of income inequality that dominated the annual meeting of the American Economic Association. Then finally, we'll speak with Mike Lofgren about his new book, The Deep State, The Fall of the Constitution and the Rise of a Shadow Government. He spent 28 years working in Congress, the last 16 as a senior analyst on the House and Senate budget committees. And we will discuss the contradictions created by the deep state, where the rich are getting richer as the poor get poorer in the land of opportunity, with the country in perpetual war while standing for peace, and while Americans talk of freedom, they are living in the surveillance state. And joining us now is Dr. William Vizard. He's a professor emeritus and chair of the Division of Criminal Justice at California State University, Sacramento. He's the author of Shots in the Dark, Policy, Politics, and Symbolism of Gun Control, and In the Crossfire, Political History of the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, as well as numerous articles on gun control, justice policy, policing, and investigations. Dr. Vizard served 30 years in law enforcement with the Fresno County Sheriff's Department and as a special agent with the Bureau of Alcohol, and Tobacco and Firearms. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. William Vizard.
Thank you.
And we spoke a while back, and you pointed out to our audience that the secondary market for guns is, I don't know what the figures are, I believe something like 40% of all gun sales are through the secondary market. And that in effect, I guess the implication is that all of our focus on gun control has been sort of kabuki theater, in as much as the only focus so far has been on the primary market, if you will, and background checks when people buy from gun stores and licensed federal arms dealers. So has that been the case up in all along, that we've sort of somewhat ignored this back door where 40% of gun sales take place?
Well, we don't know exactly what percentage it is. 40% is probably a reasonable estimate. We do know that a significant number of guns are transferred between private individuals. A certain percentage of those are one-time transactions between acquaintances, which don't constitute, in most cases, a major problem, unless the acquaintances happen to be criminals. But there is a thriving market. Gun shows are often referred to, but it isn't just gun shows. I mean, there are people selling out of trunks of cars at flea markets, on the internet, through penny saver newspapers, a number of different ways. And the nature of the market actually varies from state to state, depending on what the state laws are and what the particular buyers and sellers are trying to avoid when you get into the actual, commercial sellers that that are in fact engaged in the business but trying to avoid licensing. So, and the answer is essentially regarding licensing. The original 1968 Act said that if you engage in the business of dealing in firearms, you have to obtain a federal license. Unfortunately, when the law was passed, there was no definition of what constituted engaging in the business. And so the courts fell back on the existing law from case law regarding what constitutes engaging in the business in general. And those prosecutions of individuals who engaged in the business without a license were always relatively difficult. These are tend to be in the main, not entirely, middle-aged or older males, usually white males, no prior criminal record, who got into guns because they are interested in guns. And so the insidious character from Taxi Driver who shows up with 10 guns in a briefcase is not the real unlicensed dealer. It looks more like your grandpa. And so it was always relatively difficult to pursue those cases criminally. And my standard when I was a supervisor was you either had to warn the person directly. You had to go to him and say, you know, you're engaging in this activity. It's illegal. And if you continue to do it, we will prosecute you. Or you had to have a showing of illegal intent. For instance, the person would admit on a wire that they knew what they were doing was unlawful, or that the guns they were selling were stolen or something of this sort. Then in 1986, the Firearms Owners Protection Act was passed, incidentally through a Democratic Congress, which had been pushed by the NRA for a number of years, started out as an actual revocation of the entire Gun Control Act and got watered down somewhat. But it actually defined engaging in the business, but it did it in such a way that it makes it even more difficult to pursue unlicensed dealers, because you have to show an intent to pursue engaging in the business for the purpose of livelihood and profit. And, you know, how much livelihood is livelihood and how much profit is profit? So it took what was already a fairly difficult criminal prosecution and made it even more difficult. And so these are rather lengthy cases. They take a lot of work. And over time, the unlicensed dealers have become, I think, more egregious simply because it's more difficult to prosecute. So ATF, like any agency, is going to, you know, fish where the fish are, and it's going to take the most egregious cases. And when that happens, it tends to exacerbate the whole problem, because if you're only dealing with the really outrageous individuals, then those individuals who are somewhat close to them but not being pursued kind of set a standard for everybody else. So it varies somewhat in California, for instance, because California requires that firearms transactions between private individuals go through what's called a transfer agent, which is essentially a licensed dealer, and that the gun is delivered to the licensee. That person fills out the California Dealer Record of Sale form as well as the federal 4473 form, waits the prescribed waiting period, which California has, which most states don't. And so in California, if one is complying with the law, there's still a records check. That's not true in any of our adjacent states, Arizona, Nevada, you know, so on. In California, the California Department of Justice and ATF tend to enforce that fairly well, as far as I can ascertain, and I've been out of the business a while, at gun shows. So gun shows in California are not quite the problem they are in other states. In other states, there is no control on transfers between private individuals. So a person can go to a gun show, display a significant number of firearms, sell them across the counter with no questions asked, and unless ATF focuses on that individual, makes repeated buys from them, shows that they're in the business of acquiring guns, making profit on those guns, and then takes them to court, prosecutes them, virtually nothing can be done about it.
And again, I'm speaking with Dr. William Bazard. He's a professor emeritus and the chair of the Division of Criminal Justice at California State University, Sacramento. He's the author of Shots in the Dark, Policy, Politics, and Symbolism of Gun Control, and In the Crossfire, A Political History of the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. He's served 30 years in law enforcement with the Fresno County Sheriff's Department and as a special agent with the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. So assuming that the president can find a way to juggle funds within the Department of Justice to be able to get the extra ATF agents that he needs to improve federal gun licensing, and you've made it pretty clear that that's not easy, and he gets more FBI personnel to conduct background checks. In the arena of public opinion, it doesn't seem like that necessarily matters, because after Sandy Hook, and after all, the president teared up today when he talked about Sandy Hook, a much more aggressive bills were almost passed, and at the last minute,
I would question almost passed. There was a push in the Senate. The bill would have died in the House. There's no way. Uh-huh. It would have gotten through a Republican House.
So when you've got the head of the House now, Paul Ryan, basically dismissing what the president did today by essentially saying that the president is, rather than focus on criminals and terrorists, he goes after the most law-abiding of citizens. Now, to my mind, that doesn't make a lot of sense, because haven't background checks prevented millions of sales to felons?
Well, they've stopped innumerable sales. Whether those people went ahead and got firearms somewhere else, of course, we have no idea. But that's that's just the narrative. I mean, if every side in this issue has a narrative, and if you'll notice, the Republicans attacked the president for exceeding his authority before they even knew what he was going to do. And the reality is, he didn't do very much. And it was kind of a foolish attack. They should have waited, held their fire until at least they could see what he'd done. So they now have to sort of reposition themselves, because the narrative was, this is a great overreach of presidential authority, when in fact a more legitimate critique might have been, this is pretty much a tempest in a teapot. It doesn't amount to much.
Is this just to use the analogy of plugging a dike, and now we've got floods in the Midwest and the levees are breaking.
Yeah.
Is this a case that we have a system where there's so many holes in the levees that you just can't plug them, and we just should give up on this? Or
there are things that Congress could do, if Congress would do them, that would be modestly helpful. You have to keep in mind, we probably have somewhere north of 300 million guns in the United States. And the nature of the gun market has changed significantly in the last 30 or 40 years. And it's gone from being primarily a sporting arms market, where people bought guns kind of like they buy tools, to accomplish, you bought a gun to go duck hunting, or you got a rifle to go deer hunting or elk hunting. And, people selected the firearm for a particular purpose, to a point now where people are buying mostly handguns and black rifles. And I think they're mostly buying them just to have them. They're like Barbie dolls for men. And so there's so many guns out there that anything you do is going to have limitations on what it can accomplish. But that doesn't mean nothing could be done. I've argued for, just to start with, if Congress would define engaging in the business in a way that everybody could understand, at least it would allow ATF to pursue these cases more reasonably, and it would also put people on notice as exactly what the law is. So, for instance, if Congress said you can sell or offer for sale a specific number of guns per year, and we do that with used cars. I mean, to be a used car dealer, if you exceed a certain number of sales, you have to get a license. We do it with liquor. We do it with other things. So you could simply say, let's say, you can sell or offer for sale 6 guns a year. But if you exceed that, you're a dealer. That would be one way to attack it. Congress could require that records checks were run on private individuals, do what California's done. It would be hard to get compliance. California has not gotten good compliance. If you look at the number of transfers at the California Department of Justice that come from dealers and the number that are private individuals, it's highly disproportionate. So and the ones they are getting from private transfers are mostly out of gun shows where they can enforce it. So they're pretty good at enforcing at gun shows, but other situations are more difficult. But that would also make it harder to be an unlicensed dealer because your individual transfers would be a violation of law, and you could pursue that. So that's something they could do. We've got a small number of dealers, and the majority of dealers are honest, but there's a small number of dealers who are selling guns under the table and falsifying records and so on. And a falsification of records is only a misdemeanor because of the 86 changes in the law. So if you go in to inspect a dealer and there's 1,000 missing guns in their record, 1,000, all you can charge them with is a misdemeanor for failure to keep records. And so those little things would be very modest steps, but they would be helpful. Now, you could go beyond that. You could go to universal registration and licensing and things like that. But the chances of that happening in my lifetime in the United States are somewhere between slim and none. So sure. So these more modest things would be helpful in several ways. But nothing's a panacea when you've got over 300 million guns out there.
Right, and of course the great irony is that whenever there's a mass shooting, and the most recent one being in San Bernardino, people rush out and buy more guns.
Guns.
And when Obama got elected, people bought more guns. After 9/11, they bought more guns.
When Clinton got elected, when Obama got elected, I mean, the Heller decision established an individual, clarified the question, is there an individual right to possess a firearm? The Heller decision from the Supreme Court. And right after that, Obama's reelected, and everybody runs out and buys more guns. I mean, and if you ask them why, have them said because they're going to take our guns away. anything that's done is translated into, well, they're going to take all my guns away.
And nobody's taken away the guns of those guys traipsing around in Oregon at the moment who are breaking
the
law.
The reality is nobody's taken it. On the other side of the coin, let me speak.
Well, we've really only got 30 seconds, so go ahead.
Okay. I think that some of the advocates of gun control legislation, particularly in California, fail to see the imposition they put sometimes on individual gun owners and stigmatize gun owners. And the way to do this is to remember that if you're going to pass controls, you should pass them in such a way that they're easily complied with, easily understood, and no more burdensome than they have to be. The same way you would pass regulations on drivers or any other group.
Well, Dr. Vizard, I thank you very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
And again, I've been speaking with Dr. William Vizard, who's a professor emeritus and the chair in the Division of Criminal Justice at the California State University, Sacramento. He's the author of Shots in the Dark, Policy, Politics, and Symbolism of Gun Control, and In the Crossfire, Political History of the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. He served for 30 years in law enforcement with the Fresno County Sheriff's Department and as a special agent with the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about what is driving income inequality in the United States.
I know my destiny. It's like the sun. You see the best of me when I have got my gun. I'm gonna get me a gun. Get me a gun.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Fadi Guvenen, who's a professor of economics at the Department of Economics at the University of Minnesota, and he's currently a visiting professor in the Department of Economics at Yale University and a research consultant for the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis and a reserve associate at the National Bureau of Economic Research, and he's the co-author of a forthcoming study that examines the underlying dynamics of wealth inequality. Welcome to Background Briefing, Fadi Guvenen.
Thank you very much.
And you have, for the last few days, been, along with the 13,000 others, have been attending the American Economics Association's annual meeting. And I take it that income inequality somewhat dominated this year's annual meeting.
That's true. I have been told, actually, that there were 70 papers on inequality at the meetings this year.
And the one that you have presented, along with Nicholas Blumert and other scholars at Stanford, it's based upon 35 years of data from the Social Security Administration, and it explains why income inequality is growing and how it is reshaping the national and global economy. So how did that happen? How did that revelation, if you will, come from the data from the Social Security Administration for the last 35 years?
Sure. So just to give a quick background, economists have been studying income inequality, especially the rise in income inequality, for more than 20 years, actually. If you look at the literature, it started in the early 1990s. So in terms of, you know, inequality rising, it's not news to economists. But in terms of understanding what's driving it, we have struggled for quite a while. Economists have tried to link it to things like education, to occupation, to other observable worker characteristics. What hadn't been done to the extent that we tried is to see how inequality changed across employers. So that's the new angle in our work. And our main finding is that almost all of the rise in inequality between 1980 to today, really, has happened across employers. And the change in inequality within each firm or employer has been very much muted, with a small exception of very large firms.
So, but when you have companies, you know, like the Silicon Valley companies sort of coming out of nowhere and making overnight billionaires out of people like Mark Zuckerberg, how do they compare, for example, to the old Industrial Revolution manufacturing base that's largely crumbling, you know, like Detroit, for example? I mean, there seems to be a tremendous divergence across the job landscape.
That's absolutely true. So, again, the last 30 years have seen many big transitions, and one of them has been the decline of manufacturing, which used to employ almost 30% of the U.S. workforce around 1980. And today that number is about 11-12%. At the same time, we have seen a big growth in services, healthcare, technology, and others. However, one important finding in our work is that even when you focus within industries, so even if you just look at manufacturing firms, you see the same picture emerging, that inequality within manufacturing increased across firms. Now, the reason this is important is, and by the way, this is also true for almost every industry we looked at. You look at within healthcare, it's across the firms. You look within technology, it's across firms. And the reason this really matters is because the usual story that you hear, that it's all the CEOs or all the executives that's accounting for inequality, it's a very small part of the story. It's happening, definitely, but it's happening for very large firms. And by that, I mean firms that employ more than 10,000 workers. You see the executives and the super, you know, the C-suite, as they say, taking off. But except for that tiny fraction of firms, the top pays in those firms actually have been very much muted.
So what is, though, in terms of your research, what indicates what's driving this? Is this a result? I mean, one would hope it's something to do with the meritocracy, but I'm not entirely sure that that is the dynamic at play here. What is the dynamic at play here?
So it seems like there are two separate stories. One applies to firms that are, like I said, not super large. So if you look at firms less than 10,000 employees, and to give you an idea, these firms basically are 99.8% of all the firms, and they employ 80% of all the U.S. workers. For those firms, really, within firm, like inequality inside the firm has not changed all that much. But what is getting a lot of attention, and rightly so, are the very large firms, the Googles, the Apples, the Microsofts, and so on. And within these firms, definitely there has been a substantial increase at the top. And you started by mentioning Mark Zuckerberg. They do get a lot of attention. For those highly paid executives, the primary driver of their wages have been stock-based compensation and pay-for-performance-based compensation.
So, again, I'm speaking with Afadi Guvenin, who's the professor of economics at the Department of Economics at the University of Minnesota and currently a visiting professor at Yale University. He's also a research consultant for the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis and a research associate at the National Bureau of Economic Research. And he's the co-author of a forthcoming study that examines the underlying dynamics of wealth inequality. But my understanding that from the meeting of all the economists that have just taken place, the annual meeting of the American Economic Associations, that in terms of this discussions about growing income inequality, it wasn't so much about the top 1% anymore. It's now about the top quarter of 1%. So how has that happened, that even within the 99% versus the 1% dynamic, if you will, that came out of the Occupy movement, now we're talking about a quarter of 1%.
That's absolutely true. And actually, I would go even further. If you look at the period since 2000, the last 15 years, if you look at the top 1% earnings, just by dropping the top 0.01%, and this is a really, really small group of individuals, if you exclude those individuals, you actually see that the remaining individuals in the top 1%, their incomes did not grow at all in the last 15 years. So any growth actually happened in this really rarefied, you know, top 0.01%. And within that group, it wasn't their labor income. It was mostly capital income.
So is there a breakdown of the difference between labor income and capital income? Because my suspicion is that most of the gains are on capital income because of technology, and breakthroughs in technologies tend to concentrate wealth at the top and basically not require, in fact, replace workers with robots.
So there is a fine line in terms of, you are right, in terms of, you know, what is labor income, what's capital income, especially at the very top. But if you look at the IRS's definition, if a payment is remuneration for labor services, even though it may appear to us as capital income, it is recorded as labor income. And let me give you one example. If you are a CEO and you are awarded stock options, performance-based stock options, or restricted stock units, these are huge sums of money. And the majority, the vast majority of the income of executives come from these items. The IRS counts them as labor income because you are paid that as remuneration for your labor services. When we say capital income, we literally mean investment income. We don't mean, you know, you work in a firm and you are paid stocks or other kind of financial incentives.
So in terms of then this quarter of 1% that have seen these vast gains, are most of them like the Zuckerbergs of this world, people who've sort of invented things and invented a whole new aspect of social media, or are these more What's the percentage then of people who just basically, you know, put their money in hedge funds and inherit money and then just, like, for example, the Koch brothers inherited a lot of money, but they built their fortune largely through Wall Street and through investments on Wall Street. So I'm trying to get a sense of how much, you know, because one of the things that it concerns me about the nature of the financialization of our economy by the domination of Wall Street is that one begins to wonder whether there's more of a concentration on extracting wealth as opposed to creating wealth.
So, yes, I have a separate paper where I look at the very top earners, the top 0.1% and up. And what we see is in that group, actually, there has been a pretty dramatic change in the last 30 years. So if you go back to the 1980s, it used to be that, believe it or not, doctors actually, physicians were the top group within the top 0.1%. And right now, the number of doctors have fallen pretty dramatically to about 10% of that group. Right now, about 30% of that group are workers in finance. But the remaining 60% are pretty widely distributed. There are lots of lawyers. There are some business owners in manufacturing, in mining, and so on. So it's true that hedge fund managers and others, they get a lot of attention. But I think we should also keep in mind that there's another 70% of those very rich that come from across America, across different sectors. And they are some of them executives. A lot of them are business owners or doctors and lawyers.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, Father Gouverneur, and I just wanted to mention today that in Manhattan, Senator Bernie Sanders had a big address on Wall Street reform, where he offered his policy prescriptions, and he said that the Wall Street's business model is a fraud, and that since you work as a consultant to the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis, I'd like to mention also that Bernie Sanders says the Federal Reserve has been hijacked by bankers. So what do you think of those comments?
I don't see that from where I'm sitting. I actually am, you know, I see very professional, very dedicated economists at the Feds, they have really no connection whatsoever directly to the Wall Street folks. But, you know, that's all I'm going to say.
Right. But I think we've had the people like Geithner and company, this revolving door, haven't we? Often called government sacks. That's a phenomenon, isn't it? And the question that Bernie Sanders was asking, which apparently the audience joined in the chorus, was, does Washington regulate Wall Street or does Wall Street regulate Washington? Where would you come down on that?
I mean, my interactions with the Feds are with their researchers, not with their regulators. Mm-hmm. So I'm afraid, qualified to make a comment on that.
Right. But in terms of the power in this country, do you think it's still with Washington or has it migrated to Wall Street?
I think the big issue with Wall Street is probably with the SEC, more so than with the Feds. Because the SEC is technically supposed to be, you know, overseeing and regulating firms. And
right.
There's a separate question about how effective they have been at doing that.
Sure. Well, their budget is continually cut by the Republican Congress. So maybe that's the connection between Washington and Wall Street that we should be looking at. But I thank you for joining us, Father Gouverneur.
Sure, thank you. It's my pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Fatih Gouverneur, who's a professor of economics at the Department of Economics at the University of Minnesota, and he's currently a visiting professor in the Department of Economics at Yale University. He's a research consultant for the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis and a research associate at the National Bureau of Economic Research, and he's the co-author of a forthcoming study that examines the underlying dynamics of wealth inequality. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back talking about the deep state.
It's the money.
What's my
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Mike Lofgren, who has spent 28 years working in Congress, the last 16 as a senior analyst on the House and Senate budget committees, which gave him ringside seats on TARP, Hurricane Katrina disaster relief, debates on the Pentagon budget, and the amazing antics of various deficit reduction commissions. He's the author of the New York Times bestseller, The Party Is Over, How Republicans Went Crazy, Democrats Became Useless, and the Middle Class Got Shafted. And his latest book just out is The Deep State, The Fall of the Constitution and the Rise of a Shadow Government. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mike Lofgren.
Good to be here, Ian.
And your book points out the contradictions created by the deep state, where in this country the rich are getting richer as the poor get poorer in the land of opportunity. We're in a country in perpetual war while standing for peace, and while Americans talk of freedom, they are living in the surveillance state. So given that charge, if you will, are we all sort of fools here just watching this game show democracy in this election year? Are all of our politicians essentially ornamentation, where the real work gets done behind the scenes by invisible bureaucrats in the pockets of corporate interests and dependent upon the moguls in Silicon Valley, whose data collecting systems enable the U.S. government to spy on every move, swipe, and click?
Well, you've kind of preempted my byline.
I'm sorry.
Actually, I would say that there are certainly definable differences between politicians. Barack Obama is not George Bush. Bernie Sanders is not Donald Trump. However, there's an odd process by which people get elected and then their campaign promises get jettisoned. And certainly on certain social issues like gay marriage or abortion or gun control, these types of things, there are certainly stark differences between politicians. But those are not the money issues. On the money issues, national security, which we've spent $4 trillion extra on national security since 9/11, $4 trillion, on things like financial regulation and deregulation, who gets what. On those issues, the differences are rather narrow. George Bush had people like Hank Paulson from Goldman Sachs at the Treasury. Barack Obama had Tim Geithner from the New York Fed, who's very friendly with Wall Street. Who were his chiefs of staff? Rahm Emanuel and Bill Daley, both Wall Street-friendly Democrats. I would say they were friendly to Wall Street before they were friendly to the Democratic base.
So is this then a system we have so much paranoia on the left and the right. You've got these crackpots, patriots up there in Oregon toting their guns, and you've got all kinds of conspiracy theories about the Bush and Cheney organizing 9/11 and all this nonsense. So you've got all this sort of paranoia in this country. But it seems that what you're telling us in your book on the deep state is that this is not so much about conspiracy, but about the kind of banality of evil.
In a way. The problem is that in a sort of a platonic fashion, people on the left who go out and demonstrate in Ferguson, Missouri, or Chicago, they have issues. The right has the issues. They're starting to boil over. I'm not saying they're equivalent, but these groups who see an overarching conspiracy on 9/11 and this sort of thing, it's like they're seeing the shadows on the wall of the cave by firelight. They know there's some movement there. They know there's something wrong. They just do not recognize it for what it is. It's much more banal than some conspiracy hatched in the dead of night. It is simply bureaucrats responding to lots and lots of monetary incentives. As Sinclair Lewis once said, it's difficult to get a man to understand something when he's paid not to understand it. And our media, our think tanks, and our politicians are paid not to understand the underlying problems.
So, given that you've defined the problem and sort of cut through the paranoia and illusions and delusions here, but what drives then? What can be done to? I mean, my understanding. I've talked to people in Washington recently, you know, like an insider like Barney Frank, who spent a lot of time there, and particularly on the Finance Committee, et cetera, and you probably work with him. He made the point that you really can't do much to improve the lives of Americans through the government, which is the only way you can really do it, at any rate, unless you believe in the Koch brothers' theory that turn over the country to us and we'll make you all rich. The point being that we spend more on defense now, 60% more on defense, and you made that point earlier, than we did on an average year during the Cold War. And yet we have no serious enemies except a bunch of these Mad Max guys driving around the middle Syria and Iraqi desert with their black flags, and we're all hysterical about them. And by comparison, they're just a joke compared to the Soviet Union's ability to wipe out every American city and kill almost everybody in this country. And we spent a lot of money on that, but we're spending 60% more on this, you know, fantasy or delusion. So there's something driving that insanity. And is Barney Frank correct in his analysis that you're never going to really fix this country for the people of this country and live up to our promise and our own, you know, propaganda about the land of the free and the home of the brave, unless we do something about this?
Well, absolutely. The problem is a big S with two lines, vertical lines through it. It's dollars. World War II, from Pearl Harbor to VJ Day, lasted about 3 years and 9 months. The War on Terror has been going on for 14 years. And for that amount of time, we've been spending money at a record rate. Now, think what that does, and think how that skews people's incentives to continue that war and always to see threats. Many people are aware of how Manhattan has been basically priced so that normal people can't live there. It's an exclusive playground for the Wall Street types. The same thing with San Francisco. It's getting to be that way in Washington. I mean, all you have to do is walk through the suburbs and you see these big mansions in these infill lots. So what I conclude is there are an awful lot of McMansions and there are an awful lot of S-Class Mercedes sedans driving around the Beltway because of the so-called War on Terror. And if it ended tomorrow, those S-Class Mercedes sedans would be repossessed and their McMansions would be foreclosed on. Now, think how that skews incentives.
Well, it also, I think, you know, when you just going back to the so-called self-declared patriots with their guns up in Oregon, they're talking about a government that's, you know, supposed to be our government, but it's become a government unto itself. They obviously have a point. They've got the wrong prescription, but you know, they're identifying the right problem. How do you take this back from? I mean, it's all to do with the electoral process, to campaign finance, to the budget priorities. But I guess the first step must be, and this is probably why you wrote the book, Mike, is that somehow the American people have got to figure this out, how they're getting hosed and by whom, because they get distracted by, you know, as I say, the game show and democracy, this whole year of political theater and all this stuff. But meanwhile, you know, you have Nigeria on the Potomac just humming along, siphoning up all that money.
Right. It's a remarkable fact that during the days of the old populace in the 1890s, your average Nebraska farmer, he knew who was shafting him. He knew that Wall Street, the big railroads, and John D. Rockefeller were giving him the shaft. And he may have been barely literate, but he knew what the sort of relations were in society. The problem now is we're under such a fog of propaganda that there's millions of people who think that college professors are their enemies, or the problem is gays, or this or that. And a lot of it is conscious misdirection.
You mean?
So people need to inform themselves. And by the way, they would do better finding out, well, what's really in the federal budget, rather than obsessing over the Kardashians. People who think that foreign aid is the biggest item in the budget, when it's, you know, less than 1%, aren't going to really understand budget agreements, what's in there, and how the sausage gets made with their tax dollars.
Right, but once you say, well, you get the government you deserve, you know, that of course, is abdicating any possible change, isn't it? I mean, I'm trying to figure out here what it's going to take.
Oh, by no means. I'm saying that perhaps you get the government you deserve, but you'll deserve a better government if you take the effort for self-education. And then after there's some self-education, then there's organization to get in touch with like-minded people.
Well, I guess
we have an example of Bernie Sanders. This isn't an endorsement of his candidacy. It's a simple statement of fact that he's staying quite competitive with Hillary Clinton in fundraising. Why? Because he has an organization and he has people who like him, of like mind. His average campaign donation is something like $33. Okay, these people can't compete with the Koch brothers, but he's staying competitive somehow in fundraising because a certain segment of the population did decide that enough was enough and that they were going to make an organized effort to change things.
And I suppose there's a similar impulse on the Republican side in terms of populism. It's going to probably, if Trump were to be elected, I think it would be the first neo-fascist president that the United States ever elected. I mean, this guy is more akin to Putin and Erdogan and third world dictators in terms of his outlook and his attitude and his personal morality or amorality.
That may be true, but one thing that he appeals to is that the mechanism isn't the same as Bernie Sanders, but he's not doing the same thing as all other politicians do, which is money grub among billionaires. He's self-financing. He even tells people, hey, I was on the other end of this game, and when I said jump, politicians said how high. Mm-hmm. Those contributors don't have the strings on me, and that appeals to a certain type of person, that he's his own man. Now, you may disagree with the kind of man that is, but at least it is evidence of something different and people wanting something different from a politician who spends like 40 or 50% of his time, even when he is in office, dialing for dollars, going to fundraisers, begging for money from rich people.
Well, indeed. Donald Trump would not be a political phenomenon but for the fact that the people in this country know that the government is broken. You know, they know there's a problem, but they're sort of misdiagnosing the solution, as far as I can tell. And that's why your book, The Deep State, The Fall of the Constitution and the Rise of the Shadow Government, is so important for people to read and understand that, you know, when I mentioned Trump's sort of neo-fascism, you know, that word's thrown around a lot with you know, sort of casual hyperbole. But there is, unfortunately, some polling being done now that a lot of people are so fed up with this broken government that they have that same impulse that brought in Mussolini. You know, we need somebody that can make the trains run on time, and democracy itself is broken.
A friend of mine, who shall remain nameless, he is a Republican. He is working for a Republican candidate. Out of curiosity, he attended a Trump rally. He said he was appalled. The atmosphere was like that of a 1932 Nazi Party rally.
Well, indeed, there's a lot of gains amongst on the right in Western Europe as well. What do you think that is the psychology, though, of these people in the shadowy power elite, the deep state that you talk about, the banal bureaucrats as we talked about them in the pockets of corporate interests and powerful moguls, including the Silicon Valley types. They can't be all blind to what we're talking about, surely. What's your sense of, you know, you've made it clear that we've all got to wake up. And by extension, I would suggest that people have to read your book, The Deep State, The Fall of the Constitution and the Rise of a Shadow Government. But that said, what can be done to reform, physician, heal thyself, as they say?
Well, I think the whole campaign finance issue is at the root of it. I mean, it's much better that someone like Sanders makes thousands and thousands of small contributions than somebody like Newt Gingrich in 2012, who stayed through most of the primaries simply because of one contributor, Sheldon Adelson. Okay, it's better, but wouldn't it be better yet if we just had publicly financed elections and none of this money grubbing? Because operations like in your previous segment, the Securities and Exchange Commission, why does it get its budget cut? Why does the IRS, which is supposed to be auditing people like the Kochs, why do they get their budget cut? Because rich contributors give money to the people who are putting the provisions in law to cut their budgets.
Right, but your thesis also goes further. We know that our politicians are a bunch of whores and hirelings by and large, and they spend their days dialing for dollars. They're nothing more than political telemarketers. But the vast bureaucracy that, as you point out, explains why Obama's foreign policy is not much different from his predecessor, George W. Bush, that this is the permanent government. So, how do you get to them? Are they changeable? If it's the banality of evil, then is there a way to appeal to their better angels?
I don't know if there is, but if you had politicians who are not fearful of being voted out of office if they didn't vote the way rich contributors wanted, they would be more likely to implement policies which would keep the bureaucracy under control, keep the Pentagon under control, and certainly keep its budget under control.
Well, but my understanding is that the reason that politicians, particularly Republicans, vote for just endless amounts of money at the Pentagon is that that's a kind of Republican idea of welfare that at its heart, we're the only Western democracy that doesn't have real welfare, where, you know, you pay your taxes and you get your government services. And look what happens in France. The minute that the government tries to cut back on public services that people pay through their tax dollars, that people take to the streets. Here, we get precious little from our tax dollars as individuals, corporations and the military-industrial complex, agribusiness, they get everything they want. We get Social Security and Medicare in there, and that's under permanent attack. So do you think there's a requirement here for people to basically not get into this trap of this nonsensical argument about big government, but really start to focus an argument on better government? And
what kind of government do you want?
Right.
I don't know to the extent it was a conscious sort of plan or it was just people's preferences playing out. But you've noticed over the last 30 years, whenever Republicans get into power, they'll cut taxes. Then they'll squander lots of money on the Pentagon. You know, there's $4 trillion that have trickled through the sands of the Middle East. And having done that, they've engineered a budget crisis. And they'll say, oh, therefore we have to cut Social Security or Medicare and so forth. Or we have to, not build any more highways.
Right. Well, that's what happened
under
Reagan.
That's the way it works out, as a kind of their own welfare, as a way of squandering the opportunities for things like Social Security. And then they can let the ideologues at the Cato Institute go to work who simply don't like Social Security for ideological reasons. You could prove 6 ways to Kansas that the system was solvent, they'd want to cut it anyway.
Right. Well, Mike, we've run out of time. I thank you very much for joining us. And again, Mike Lofgren spent 28 years working in Congress, the last 16 as a senior analyst on the House and Senate Budget Committees. He's the author of the New York Times bestseller, The Party Is Over, How Republicans Went Crazy, Democrats Became Useless, and the Middle Class Got Shafted. And his latest book just out is The Deep State, The Fall of the Constitution and the Rise of a Shadow Government. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time was